Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by the head indoor coach at the University of Washington, Keegan Cook. Keegan, thanks for joining us.
John, Billy, thanks for having me. Good to talk with you guys.
So today, our topic for the show is about how to be a great assistant coach. And I know you've assisted at some really great programs through the years. So I was wondering what some of the things are that you focused on as an assistant coach.
Man, big question. I'm going back into my memory a little bit to try and remember.
Been a couple of years, I know.
You know, maybe the first thing that I think about as an assistant is just trying to go into a situation, really trying to understand the program that you're joining and what they value from a maybe a core value standpoint and from a volleyball standpoint. But then also making sure that you're identifying kind of maybe an area of weakness where you think you're going to go for it and try and make an impact on that program. And so I'm thinking back to when I was fortunate enough to join Washington for Jim McLaughlin. And the first thing that I did was watch every match of their Pac-12 season from 2012. And from start to finish, I think I actually ended up data volley coding all of them, just because when I did that, I really thought that I, you know, had a really complete view of it and just tried to just get a real clear understanding of what Jim valued without having to ask him. So then maybe that was the first thing that I started with, is before I came in there guns blazing trying to change things or give my ideas, just as quickly and as thoroughly as possible have an understanding of what I was joining.
And just from
a big undertaking, sorry. Go ahead, Billy.
No, so just from watching the video, like I guess what did you get out of that you saw as like his team values?
Yeah, I think right away, what you see or what I saw back in 2012 was a team that was just so fundamentally sound in their movements, you know, extremely efficient, really repeatable from match to match, environment to environment. You just saw these really consistent movements, especially in the blocking and attacking phases of the game, just across the board from every athlete, you know, just the way they moved in unison. You could just tell that had to be something. It doesn't just happen, you know, as you know. It has to be something that the team values. Passing, you know, you could tell that was a priority, just really simple and, again, fundamentally sound, passers looking alike in terms of how they move. And, I mean, there were a lot of things, of course, that impressed me in that first time watching Washington, you know, really closely. And then there were a couple areas that I thought, okay, maybe there's some room where I can help or at least, you know, make a slight improvement this next upcoming season.
And then as you know, coming into a program and, you know, having a coach like Jim, was he open to hearing about those weaknesses, or how do you approach kind of letting a head coach know about these things?
Yeah, I think it's funny, I'm trying to think back to that time, and man, Jim sure gave me a lot of rope to hang myself with. he really allowed me to spend a lot of time with the servers in the gym and to bring some ideas on middle attacking. And I think he knew that I just really wanted Washington to be great. They had an outstanding team, you know, in 2013, ended up going to the Final Four. And boy, I didn't want to screw it up, you know, and I hope, you know, that I think he sensed that and saw that I was kind of in there working. But for an assistant going into that situation, I think now being on the other side of it, it's just so easy to point out things that aren't going well for a team, you know, to watch some film and to get an idea and get fired up about it and run into the office and say, hey, look what I found. We need to be better at this. And here's my idea. And I think more assistants need to try and change less, but change it, you know, for the better and focus on it every single day. You know, there's nothing more frustrating as a coach than to have someone come in with an idea and you go for it. And then 2 weeks later, they forget all about it and they're on to the next thing, you know, and just if you want to make an impact in an area, it has to be day to day and you have to follow through on it. And that would be my biggest suggestion to an assistant coach, you know, now being on the other side of it. Just, hey, I'm with you. If you're fired up on this idea, go for it, but see it all the way through, you know, and own it and know that, you know, you gotta deliver on it.
Nice. And you mentioned Jim McLaughlin, and you also worked under Rob Browning. What were some things that you learned from them and that you've brought with you to your program now?
With Rob, maybe one of the biggest things I learned is you don't turn down help from people who are passionate about helping your program. You know, I think there were times when people would walk into our gym at St. Mary's and say, hey, I want to help. And Rob would say, okay, here you go. Here's your job, you know, however small it was. And I would sometimes look at him like, who is this guy? You know, he's shagging balls. We don't know him. And Rob would just kind of say yes to people who expressed an interest in joining his program. And I think back to how I started my career. I was a sophomore in college, and at St. Mary's, Rob had just gotten the job. And I played a little bit of club volleyball and knew some players on the team. And they mentioned to Rob that I might be able to spend some time with the program. So I walked in the office. He said, yeah, here's this laptop, this program on it. It's called Data Volley. I'm going to go now, figure it out, you know. And that's how it all began for me. And so I've tried to carry that through with my program now. I have the ability to hire people for different positions, and it makes such an impact. You are so much more than just your own abilities as a coach. You know, the number of people that you hire, how well you develop them, how much time you invest them, it just magnifies, you know, your own strengths. And so I think that's been one of the greatest things that Rob taught me is, hey, get people on board, good people, and spend time with them and give them responsibilities, and they'll really help you out.
And then what about from Jim? Were there any big lessons from him?
You know, there's tons of lessons. The first one that I think about with Jim is just this open door policy in his gym. You know, I mean, literally the gym doors are open and people from all over the country, sometimes all over the world, would be coming in to watch practice, and they would spend time in Jim's office. They wouldn't sit kind of in, you know, a general team space. They would sit in Jim's office and he would talk with them and hear their stories and spend time with them. And everyone was always welcome. And, you know, just that idea of being open and allowing information to move in and out of your program is something that I've tried to keep going. You know, I've got lots of people that I've met, lots of ideas I've picked up from people outside of our program. And so that's maybe the first thing that comes to mind, you know, when I think about, you know, what I observed with Jim and running his program.
Some pretty great mentors you got to have. It's pretty cool. So now as a head coach, what are some of the qualities you look for when you're hiring an assistant coach?
Yeah, good question. What do I look for? I really believe that skills can be taught, and you know, pretty much any skill, you know, you're never really prepared for the job that you don't have is something that I believe. You know, you could have an assistant coach who was great at one school and then you bring them into your organization and it just doesn't necessarily really work. I think every job is unique in what it requires. So really try and find people who have high character. And one of my favorite things to do is to call, you know, not just one or two references, but 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people who know the person that you're trying to hire, and just listen to what they say. And I'm not necessarily trying to hear exactly what they're saying, but what I'm hoping is that they all say the same thing. If everybody that this person has met the same person, to me, I think that's a really good sign, you know, that they treat every person that they run into, no matter whether it's Karch Karai or some fan off the street who's interacting with them, they treat them with, you know, a similar level of respect. And I think that says a lot about somebody, and some of the best people I know kind of live their lives that way.
So you were saying earlier that as an assistant coach coming in, you try to figure out what is the program value. So now as a head coach, what are some things that you value that assistant coaches come in and go, those are the core values of this program?
Yeah. usually I get that question about what do you value for your players, not so much with your staff. So it's good to hear that. I have come to really value candor. You know, I think candor, the willingness to tell somebody a hard truth is just so valuable. And I think back to a great assistant coach who I had, Jonathan Winder, and I tell this story a lot. In my second season here as a head coach at Washington, we were, you know, in the second half of Pac-12 play in a really tight race with Stanford and UCLA, I believe, for a Pac-12 title. And we were week in, week out, separated by a game or tied. And I certainly was feeling the pressure to try and win another Pac-12 title. And so a lot of my coaching became focused strictly on results and standards and stats. And we need to meet these standards and you've got to make that play. And a lot of just result oriented as opposed to process oriented feedback. And, you know, Jonathan walked in one day and after a particularly tough practice, and he's kind of pacing around my office and trying to get a point across. I said, "Jonathan, what's up?" And he said, "Hey, I've played for a lot of coaches all over the world, and I've played with coaches who are coaching like you're coaching right now. And I'll tell you right now, I would not want to play for you right now." And when Jonathan Winder tells you that he wouldn't want to play for you right now, it's not a problem with Jonathan Winder. It's a problem with you. You know, and the needle on the record player kind of stopped. You know, it's kind of one of those moments, and it's like there's some silence. And I think I looked in and I said, "Yeah, I got it. I'll see you tomorrow." And, you know, walked out to my car and did some lonely work on just what I was doing and might have, you know, turned things around for us in terms of how I coached the last few weeks of that season.
Can you let us know what are some of the things you did?
What did I change in my coaching behavior?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just a lot less conversation, like I said, about standards and results, a lot less conversation about I'm trying to think back to that time. I was very inflexible with you know, mistakes that players were making, and it wasn't about learning as much as it was about performing right now. And, you know, I think in a certain way I was violating one of my own principles that I tell the kids, which is we want to try and be ourselves in all conditions. And here we were in a different condition. And I certainly was not being, you know, the coach that I aspire to be most days. And so whenever you're violating your own principles, you're in some big trouble, I think. So, easy way to put it, I probably just relaxed, you know, and just let the players play and just lived with what happened, and what happened was some good stuff.
I was going to ask, do you remember if it made an impact, that change?
Well, we ended up winning, so I have to believe that it made a difference, you know, and you know, you'd have to ask my athletes and maybe Jonathan and Leslie Gabriel who were there in the office with me, but I think for sure there was more of a recommitment to some of the things that we started talking about early in the season, you know, about being ourselves in some really gnarly conditions when, you know, you're playing for a conference title or playing in the tournament.
I checked in with Jonathan before we talked to you, and that was one of the things he mentioned, that you're often very open and vulnerable with your staff and ask the same of them. And I guess I was going to ask what the reason why, but it sounds like that's why you do that. And I'm wondering, I guess, how you kind of able to create that environment.
Yeah, a little bit of it is a conscious choice, you know, to just make sure people feel like they can say anything at any time. And when people are contributing to your program, whether it's your players or your staff, when they have input, then I think they have ownership. And when they have ownership, they're just going to do an outstanding job, you know. And the joke I always tell with our players, or the thing I always say with our players, is when's the last time you washed a rental car, you know? And that's the that's the real meaning of ownership. You know, nobody washes a rental car, and but if it's your car, you know, you take care of it. And so when people feel ownership in a program, they're just going to give you the best of what they have. And so part of it, I think, is a conscious choice to make sure that there's a just open communication. And then the other half of it might be just many times where I go, hey, I don't know everything. There's no way. And if I did, I'd probably be in big trouble. I've been doing this for 2 or 3 years. You know, I've been coaching for 15 years, but I've been a head coach at this university for 3 years. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know everything, you know. And so maybe those two factors contribute to why, you know, that's an environment that I value.
Do you ever fear, like, you know, with that environment creating uncomfortable conversations and situations?
Yeah, you know, I was someone who, you know, my natural self, I'm not someone who handles awkward situations well. You know, I'm one of those people who, if there's like an awkward situation going on, I sometimes physically distance myself, you know, and so it had to be somewhat of a learned skill, you know, of you're just going to sit in this, you know, and let it pass. And, you know, just, you're going to have to sit in this uncomfortable conversation and just keep it going. And once you do that enough times, you know, I think like all skills, you get better at it. And I'm trying to think of some stories that kind of reiterate that point a little bit better for you guys. So here's a story. I think early on in my coaching career, you know, maybe in the first 6 months of taking over at Washington, when I was drinking through a fire hose, as I like to say, a lot of things were in my eyes not going well. You know, I had an athlete fail a class. I had, you know, I think I had a player push a football player into a bush or something. I don't know. I had all these things not going well, you know, and I called either Rob or Marv. I called somebody and I told them all these things that I thought were going wrong. And I had certainly had some feelings that, hey, the players, you know, they're not working as hard as they did when Jim was here. You know, that was probably just my own anxiety. It wasn't a reality. And I told this coach that, and finally, kind of at the end of it, they said, okay, that's, you know, sounds like a lot. You know, you're paid to get bad news, right? And it's a saying that pretty much changed the whole, my whole paradigm on being a head coach, you know. And where's bad news supposed to go? You know, bad news goes up. It doesn't go sideways. You know, if something's not going well, you want your players to come tell you, you know, where else do you want them to go? And so that's a saying that I think has kind of stuck with me. You know, I'm paid to get bad news, and I'm paid to be there on a player's worst day. And, you know, that's probably another value that I try and bring to life.
Nice. And you mentioned that with assistance and people helping out, that skills can be learned. Once you do have your staff in place, what do you do to help develop them?
Yeah. A couple things that I think help in developing your staff. One is, you know, trying to make sure that they're a little bit at the edge of their ability level, you know, and maybe the greatest example of that would be, you know, sometimes when I hire a new staff member, you know, I've hired a new assistant twice now, and you start off and you're writing practices, you know, and then in time you ask them to write a portion of practice, and then in time you ask them to write, you know, a larger portion of practice, and then, you know, you get to a point where you say, you know what, this spring season or for the next 6 weeks, you've got all the morning practices, you know, and we need to develop in these areas and let's see what you got. And just kind of make sure that they're a little bit outside where they're comfortable, you know. And then hopefully, you know, for those staff members who've been around for 6 months to a year, you know, kind of asking them questions of, hey, what do you want to get better at, and what aren't you doing that you want to do? And I think those are two things that are a big deal. I don't think people realize how important, you know, when you're a head coach, you pretty much have two teams. You know, you have 13 to 18 players. And at Washington, I think I probably have somewhere close to 12 staff members. You know, it's like you're coaching two teams, and you gotta make them both great.
So I love the idea of getting your coaches to the edge of their abilities. I think it's something we ask of players all the time, but not always something that coaches do. So I'm wondering how you do that for yourself then, if you don't have someone kind of pushing you in that way.
Yeah. How do I push myself? First of all, you got to have people who challenge you. You know, I think Jonathan Winder, you know, my first hire, you know, I told you about his candor, but certainly someone who had a strong opinion in a lot of areas and, you know, would challenge me often. And you, as a head coach, you have to have this appreciation for it, even though it can drive you crazy sometimes, you know. And I would joke with Jonathan at times, I'd say, hey, quit coaching me and go coach the players, you know. And but that's a big deal, you know. And Leslie Gabriel is the same way, you know. She to me represents someone who has just a long understanding of how to be successful at Washington specifically. She's been there 15 plus years, I think, and has won a national championship, and she's keeps me grounded to some principles that, you know, we know lead to success. I try and say yes to things that I'm not that comfortable with, you know, some coaching clinics. I did a coaching clinic in Canada, did a coaching clinic in Salt Lake City. I've coached the college national team a few years ago. I'm currently at the Olympic Training Center coaching the junior national team. That has been...
You're doing a podcast?
What's that? Yeah, I'm doing a podcast. podcast with you guys.
Dude, way outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, certainly not something I'm comfortable with. But my intuition is, wow, I've never done that. I'm going to do it. You know, anytime I find myself saying, yeah, I've got no idea how to do that. Yeah, let's do that. You know, and it kind of just kind of jump in and figure it out. And it's kind of been a little bit of a theme throughout my my coaching career.
So when you have a new hire, a new staff come in, they're, you know, they obviously have had different coaching experiences and maybe see things a different way. How do you get, you know, the staff to be on the same page philosophically? Are there books you use or resources to get, yeah, kind of everyone aligned? Or do you want them aligned?
Yeah. So this is my second time. You know, when I first got hired, I don't think I was in any way, shape, or form ready to kind of organize the staff. Thankfully, a lot of people stayed on board, you know, a lot of the support staff and technical directors and volunteer assistants, all these people were, you know, still on board. And so Jonathan and I were the only two people who were really in new roles. This time around, you know, I think we just had six staff members get, you know, new jobs or full-time positions at other schools. And so this time around, all of a sudden it felt like, okay, I need to get everyone organized here. And so did a couple presentations for the first time ever in my career where we talk about kind of the structure of the staff and here are the things we value. And, you know, these are our responsibilities and have that kind of, you know, just, I don't know, it was an interesting experience for me doing it this time around. There were so many new people that I had to try and get organized. And so that was the route that I went this time around, of just a little more formal presentation, you know, to try and get us all on the same page.
And when you were an assistant coach, if there's something the head coach was doing that maybe you guys didn't see eye to eye on, whether it was just training methods or feedback or something, I guess, how did you approach that? And can you think of any examples?
Yeah, let me think of some examples. The first thing I would say, of course, is pick your battles, you know, pick your battles. And, you know, like I said before, if you're passionate about something, you better be passionate about it all year. And don't just kind of disagree to disagree. What is an example of something? You know, I think one of the things I've noticed with assistant coaches is just this desire to have a bunch of novel drills, a bunch of different drills. You know, that's one of the areas that they come in where they think, hey, let's do serve and pass this way, or let's do this outside hitter competition this way, and let's this number of balls in this many minutes. And what I've realized is it's not about having a million different drills. It's about, having maybe little variations to one drill so that your athletes aren't thinking about the score or when do I rotate. Because every time you introduce a new drill, it's going to cost you a day. And when I became the head coach, the feeling I generally have is I can't afford to lose a day. We can't spend a day learning this drill and then have it tomorrow. Is this drill that much better than, doing serve and pass this way? If not, then why change it? So that would be, a suggestion to many assistant coaches who are joining programs. Just understand the structure of the activity that your coach is doing and why they do it. And if you can improve it, go for it. If your change doesn't improve it in some significant way, then why bother, make an impact somewhere else. Don't be upset. I think a lot of assistant coaches, they'll bring an idea to the table. It'll get shot down maybe, and they'll get discouraged. And, I know quite a few assistant coaches around the country, and from time to time they'll express frustration. And I just want to tell them, hey, keep going. Keep throwing ideas at them. Some will stick, some won't. And that's just the way it is.
Can you give us one of those staple drills, say if you want to work on serving that day? Can you take us through one?
So maybe a seam serve and pass drill is something that we spend a lot of time on. I think serving seams and passing seams is just an area that we want to be great year in and year out. And so maybe we do, we've got two courts. We've got two passers on each court and some servers serving at them. And we're going to do 4 3-minute rounds, and we're serving and passing, and we're talking about communication, we're talking about seam responsibilities, maybe we're talking about mechanics. We can change what we talk about each day based on where we think we're not good. But then maybe a coach says, can we serve, out of 10, see how many we get out of 10? Can we serve two in a row, one passer? Can we put three passers out there? Can we have them pass half the court? And just, it's serving and passing, and we're serving seams and we're passing seams. And, our feedback is more important than the structure of how we get, this number of balls into the seam. It's not that complicated. Let's just roll this thing out and let's go. Let's be great about what we tell our athletes with our feedback. And that's it. So maybe that's the best example I can give. But there's lots of other examples, in wash drills. There's a ton of different ways you can score a wash drill. And, from day to day, I just think I like running the same practice maybe 2 days in a row. Maybe having a hitter tournament that lasts 2 days, so that by the second day the athletes are just moving through it seamlessly. And they have just zero mental effort to how the drill scored or run, and all of their focus is on how they move and what they see and how they communicate.
I like that. So the drill stays the same, but it's more the area that the coaches are giving feedback on, that, or maybe the specific focus. That's what changes more often.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's where the magic's at, hey, today we're going to change speeds on you, going back to that seam serve and pass. And passers, we got to see the speed of the serve. We got to see the arm of the server. We got to move up on it, and that's the feedback. And so you have this same activity with a tiny variation, and your servers are back there changing their speeds pretty consciously. And that to me would be a good example of making a variation. You don't need to write up some other new number of rounds or things like that.
That was part one with Keegan Cook. He's back next week, and we hit him with some hard listener questions. Thanks for listening.